All right. It's awesome to be doing round two of the interview with Meta Nomad, who we know is James Ellis. So thanks for hanging out with us, James.
That's cool. I'm glad. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah.
Happy to be back.
Now is a really great time to actually have you on, because as anyone who follows your Twitter or mine will know, your book recently came out, The Methodology of Possession, subtitle On the Philosophy of Nick Land. So this was a real passion project for you.
Yeah. It's like, in terms of research, 3 years in the making, and then in terms of like, and if I'm honest with myself, in terms of doing it, 2 years in the making, mainly because it was really tough to write. I don't know why. So I think it's procrastination, mixture of procrastination, laziness, and maybe, but I don't know if it was those things. Like, I was really near the end. I was really struggling to force it out with the power of will. That sounds really pretentious, but it was just ridiculously tough near the end to even get it onto paper. I guess anyone who's written anything long will understand. It's just a case of like, God, I wish the words would literally just get on the paper. But yeah. And it's funny, I was doing an interview yesterday and a couple of people said, oh, congratulations on your book release. And I said, well, like, they were both authors. And I said, well, you'll know, it's not really a congratulations. They were like, no, it's just a release. And I was like, yep, it's just a release. And like a massive relief that it's out of your system. So yeah, complete passion project, really.
It's funny because the passion, I relate to this a bit because I wrote an article about EMDR therapy, and it started as this idea I was very passionate about. And as I went through the editing process and was back and forth with the editor of this publication that I was publishing it in, I was like, okay, here's this, here's that. And it becomes like your passion has to override your desire to just put it down and be done. So I get what you're throwing down on that front. And with a narrative, I'm sure it's more complex because you're trying to figure out just the right way to wrap it up, like you said. So that's wild. Okay. So let's dive in here to kind of the beginning of the book, let me rewind it. What's something unexpected that you learned that's different? Because listeners will know that you have a really cool blog where you post a lot about accelerationism and, essays about that and other concepts, but what's different about writing a book from that you didn't expect?
What, a book about sort of that's those sort of topics?
Yeah, or like the format of a book versus blog or articles. Yeah,
I really struggle with it because there's this I think I've said this a long time ago. There's this artist called Luke Timmons, and he's quite a big artist, but he states that he can't, all his paintings are done in a day because he says that he's in a certain contextual headspace, so they have to be done in that day. He just physically can't return to paintings because you're in a completely separate context of mood. So I sort of struggle with that in terms of, I like writing blog posts because, and I'll get them done in a day and often edit and proofread them in the day because I want them to be done. That was the context they're written in. And so I had this, I'm happy to talk about the process of writing the book, I think, because I think it, maybe I'm telling the truth, maybe I'm not, but it opens up the realities of writing a book for people who maybe like were thinking they can't. And actually I split it into 500 word sections and labeled them all, and labeled them all of what I wanted to explain in that section, how, whatever form or method or style I did, it didn't matter, but it's like, it was a way of approaching a book without actually having to write a book. I think that's the problem. So it meant that I could do sort of sometimes four or five of them in a day, and it was all in the same context. The problem was when you come to sort of weave all those together, some the paces and the flows, and sometimes the style was sort of all over the place. And some were, in my opinion, better than others. So it's, I had to balance it out. It was quite tough. I probably would stick to that method of writing books as well, again, because it's the same thing. It's like a completely different thing to write it the next day.
Yeah, it's a really good suggestion because I hear a lot from people about like the daunting task they're writing, and the National Novel Writing Month, the gist of that is like write a certain amount a day for 30 mm-hmm. days. And so, I mean, that's like the radical version of that, of like, I'm going to sit, I'm just going to write something and have it be this amount of words, whatever it is, I'm going to do it. So what you're saying is like, be very intentional, 500 word sections. I think that way, I mean, that's very much a therapeutic way of looking at it, where you've got a goal that's very imposing, and then you're turning it into something that's far less anxiety provoking. And I think when people do that, it seems like more manageable for sure.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
So let's go back here. Since it's in the actual title of the book, that this is a philosophy of Nick Land kind of treatise here of book length. When did you get into Land? I mean, this is in the book, people. I mean, I know there's dramatized accounts and things like that. Well, let's start there. You call it what? Fiction as theory? Is that the genre?
Theory fiction.
Yes.
Which is sort of the genre that Land, you know, birthed in a way, along with others. I think it's always, I don't know if he can entirely be credited with that, because I think nowadays we might have considered Lovecraft theory fiction. It's just less parts theory, more parts fiction. But I think there's other writers who were doing that before Land. I think that framework's always been there, but I think it became signified with Land. As for your other question of sort of how I came across Land, mm-hmm. the reality is whether or not the person in the book is me uh-huh. is sort of up for question. Uh-huh. I think I would say it's many people. That's the impression I've got so far. People who've spoken to me about it, they said they really, really enjoyed the start of the book because they can really, really relate. So I sort of based that on a lot of what I was seeing, inclusive of my own experience. The banal reality of how I came across Land is really weird, because in a way, I started my master's and I didn't even, in continental philosophy, which is sort of what Land is known for in a way, I started that without even knowing about his work. I never used to use Twitter. And so this was back in 2016. I never used to use, in fact, it might have been before that. I think it's 2015 now. Yeah. What year was Brexit? 2016?
Yeah, I think so.
So this would have been 2015 then. And it's 2015, 2016. Anyway, I never used to use Twitter. I used to have an account, never used to use it. And I would, in moments, absolute boredom. It'd be like the last app I went on just to see, I don't know, I didn't really know how to use it, whatever. And I remember searching a hashtag for Brexit and a Twitter account called Texit Machine, I think he's gone now, came up. And in his replies was Land, who replied quite a few. And I remember at this point, I was like anti-Brexit lefty. And I remember finding Land's replies. I didn't know it was Land at that time. It was just outsideness with his heart clutching photo. And I think I remember finding the replies compelling, and I sort of followed him. So at this point, he was just like an abstract entity to me. I followed him and then sort of, you know, figured out who it was from these breadcrumbs, and eventually went to Zeno Systems and then looked in the about. And then I think the only reason I, you know, is just looked at the email. I was like, and then I looked up Nick Land and I was like, oh, okay, this is this guy. And then I sort of came across him, and I remember, and then I was just drawn to it. I won't sort of gush too much about what, you know, but everyone has their philosophical obsessions and possessions. And, you know, Land was one of mine, along with other thinkers as well. And then I think it slowly started to sort of build, and how strange this whole thing was, because I remember emailing my tutors at the time about Land, and one of them didn't even comment on the email.
Yeah.
And one of them said,
that's in the book.
Yeah. That is in the book. That's true. And one of them said he was just the infant Terrabal at Warwick. And I was like, this is really weird that they still remember him, and that's all they have to say. I still have those emails somewhere. Quite funny.
Wow. Yeah, and that was 2016 when Brexit was voted on.
So in the space of 4 years, I've gone from sort of not knowing him to being so obsessed that I wrote this book.
Yeah. Well, I it's funny that it's again another point of commonality here, because I was still in grad school to become a therapist. I was at the library and I saw this book on contemporary French philosophy. And I mean, it was kind of stretching the bounds of what contemporary is, because it had from Sartre all the way to Deleuze, and it had Lacan. Like Deleuze was obviously the latter time period of contemporary. That's like that's really going into the 80s, and he only died in like 95, I believe, was the year. So I remember being extremely fascinated by this idea that psychoanalysis was so unbelievably narrow with the family unit, and that desire is this active force and not always symbolic of a lack, and that it's like this powerful creating force in itself. And so I'm not just going on a self-indulgent tangent here. I was actually going to kind of lead into organically a lot of your early explorations in this book, like when you explore Land's philosophy and you begin a ritual, which is pretty early on in the book, you begin to see these lines of connected temporal energy. You see everything is kind of like a vulgar, banal, energetic relation in a way that sounds like rhizomes. And like you start on page 59, really beginning with those references to Land talking about Deleuze, right? Like the body without organs is the matter that always fills space to given degrees of intensity. And so I thought, okay, so we really are going there, because I started to infer a lot about Deleuze early on. So anyone who's a D&G fan, check out this book, which I think the audience really overlaps, right? Like almost a
one. Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
So, but I thought that was really awesome. So finding a philosopher and then really like, okay, I relate to this. What resonated most with you about Land? What are some of your favorite ideas from it? I know it's going to be tough. Pick a few. I know that's a long conversation, but I figured I'd ask early on. So,
when you say ideas, it's the sort of one that is beneath them all, which is like this dark, almost dark perennialism, which is, you know, Land seeking to find the kernel of all thought. And the one thing that I like about him, which is the reason I keep returning to him, and I think it's the reason people keep returning to whoever the philosopher they're obsessed with is for Land. For me, Land is like as far as I can get. You know, I have yet to get beyond that in terms of, you know, a lot of things get drawn back and I'll go, okay, that's interesting, but Kant disproves it. You sort of get stuck on this Kant thing. Now, Land takes Kant in interesting directions. And, you know, so in terms of, you know, this notion of teleoplexy, in terms of capitalism as being an artificial intelligence and capitalism, you know, subsuming everything into it and becoming this, as I say, intelligence, I find it very, very difficult to get beyond that because sort of I can intuit that in terms of what's going on. Other people, of course, will get, you know, their obsession will stop with Nietzsche, and they'll say that what I'm on about is actually something to do with the will to power, or people get stuck with, let's say, death anxiety is a big one. A lot of people say, well, how do we get beyond death? Or finitude is one. So for me, you know, I don't think it's particular to Land in that sense, that he's just the person who's right at the end of philosophy for me, you know, sort of the bleeding edge. I mean, in terms of ideas, the book follows a sort of current of the way in which I think people sort of approach Land, in terms of you come to one conclusion and then Land breaks it. So there's a critique, right, of you know, modernity in there and education, which is really base level and like just sort of humorous. And right, then it moves to D&G, as you say. And then I'll try to keep this relatively lucid, then critique, then intelligence, and then horror. And all of these things follow a trajectory, in my opinion, and each builds off the last. So you sort of get to the end of, let's say, critique, and you go, oh, we're really talking about intelligence here and how intelligence is building on itself. And then what, you know, limits and delimits intelligence is actually whatever we find in cosmic horror. And then cosmic horror is in relation to zero. Zero is right at the end of this whole thing. And I won't spoil anything there. But that was the thing. Land always took on his conceptions and was more rigorous to critique them himself. And so the conclusions he's come to are ones that I find within that system are difficult to critique because they're at the end of it. So, you know, the ideas for me was, one of the big ideas was the fact that he was sort of ruthless with his philosophy. He didn't care for it.
Brilliant. I mean, and my appreciation for Deleuze, the idea of like apparatuses of capture and a control society where now things are just spat out according to me, Deleuze and Foucault takes Foucault and he adds more language. And I know that's a bastardization on par with nothing else, but the idea of control and discourses and taking the cybernetic language and saying, okay, this apparatus of control and things like body without organs and intensities and flow, it's like the hydraulic metaphor framework, that terminology that Freud used, but on steroids or some kind of stimulant more likely. But, and so seeing how Land uses that, and he says, okay, well, that's zero. Zero is this positive feedback that subsumes and consumes everything. That helped me. That was kind of a scaffolding to me understand that, to help me understand that concept of zero. It's like not existential angst or malaise. It's this potentiation. Oh, and your explanation, by the way, of zero accelerationism on your blog, I heavily recommend anyone, because see, I actually read the book and then went back to your blog and saw that recent post. And I wish I had done the reverse. I wish I had checked out that blog post first, because for one thing, there's some really succinct explanation there of zero, that concept, and of how your nuanced take on accelerationism is both optimistic and pessimistic. It's nuanced, right? It's very dialectical. It's both and, embracing both and not saying, okay, it's going to be great and we're going to be liberated, or we're going to be in the singularity. No, here, what's going to happen is new solutions, but that bring some new problems, right? I really like
that. I disagree that it's dialectical, just because I think I might be allergic to dialectics.
Oh.
I try to put it, no, it's okay. It's just more in the vein of that the what we'd consider the negatives coming from zero.
Yes.
This is sort of the Deleuzean thing of saying that any negative can actually be a positive. So it's sort of like whatever happens in terms of neg entropy and collapse is itself this positive thing, which can be reformulated into the whole system.
Nice.
You know, so I just don't like the word dialectics.
No, that is completely fair. The way that I use it is completely different typically than a lot of philosophers, because there's this therapy called dialectical behavior therapy where you take something like, this is a horrible situation and I can choose to do well. And so it's kind of a, they call it like a both and thinking. And so you take the dialectics and you like make them make sense on your own. It's for people who have really bad emotion regulation who can like validate themselves while also choosing not to have an emotional breakdown, right? And so What you're talking about in this blog, I have to say, I'm really glad I found that before I interview, because I think you're really spot on. And I hate to say it because it's such an annoying thing, but your prognostication for the way Life Coach Twitter is going to go, because I'm watching that in real time. And for listeners, like I'll let you say it, but I wanted you to hit on that while I'm thinking about it here, your idea for what the motivational Twitter space and just the internet space is going to look like. You gave some predictions.
Oh,
was that people,
was that on a, okay, sorry, go ahead.
On your Meta Nomad blog, prediction that people are going to be required to be positive all the time, or you're not going to have any kind of space to have empty, you're gonna be productive all the time, and it will be, and there will be competitions at work, and you'll end up sleeping at the office.
Oh yeah. Self-improvement culture.
The self-improvement culture. Yeah. I call it life coaching culture because I'm so like, there's such cringe stuff out there for that. And it's
yeah, no. This is a huge, this is a huge problem for me, which is sort of aside from the book, but it is in there. And I think you can underline it as the problem that no one's going to be allowed to do nothing.
Yes.
That concept doesn't really exist. And like, I'm not a big fan of these sort of Eastern, New Age Eastern gurus who spout like truisms, but one of them is quite good, which is by Krishnamurti, which I reference, is, you know, people are becoming well adjusted to a sick society, which sounds like something the Joker would say, right? But the adjustments that people are making in terms of this improvement culture, I'm all for self-improvement, but I'm not for self-improvement for self-improvement's sake. So people should improve out of sort of an essential idea that they want to improve in some aspect. Self-improvement culture has sort of boxed off what should be included in self-improvement culture. So I think there's certain things within self-improvement culture where if you were to do them, say you wanted to spend like 10 hours a day getting good at, I don't know, something a bit more obscure that they don't consider, sort of classically improvement, I don't think it would be allowed. And I think that aesthetic of improvement is a bit dangerous. Just for people who maybe, you know, it's a difficult line. There's a fine line between not improving. I don't know. It's tough to find the line, but my criticisms of that culture are sort of come from that Dan Bilzerian culture. So the aesthetic of self-improvement is outlined by the kind of things that you see typically on Instagram. And I think it's like, you're not really trying to improve yourself. You're trying to improve yourself to become someone else. And actually, I keep getting drawn back to George Gurdjieff's work. If you've ever read any George Gurdjieff, a lot of people now are starting to understand for a psychological framework, but he really works for the idea that we're all just wearing a mask and it takes a serious amount of effort to rip that off and to be sincere and honest with yourself. And I think this is a lot of the problem, is a lot of self-improvement, I think, is actually thickening the masks that we have on, instead of sort of actually getting to the essence and then improving our actual self. As soon as you get to questions of like authentic self, this is when I sort of waver and I'm sort of don't want to talk about it because it's risky footing. But yeah, what's going to actually happen is I just feel like it's just going to go mad. It's just going to seem a bit absurd.
Oh wow. Okay. He was really into mystic stuff. Okay. Well, so
yeah, I mean, he was a mystic before anything else, okay. But a lot of his followers would now say,
yeah,
actually he was sort of before anyone else in terms of understanding, you know, what we now understand psychology.
Right. Well, I would say my bone to pick with that is a very, well, very appropriate that we're talking about Nick Land and kind of this understanding of capital. I think what it is it's the Mick help, we could call it, like Mick psychology, where like Mick mindfulness was a term, I think there's an article about that, like mindfulness that is used as a temporary pressure release valve so you can go back to your job living in your futuristic cubicle where you have your hour-long VR break, right? It's like using it's not self-improvement if it's teaching you how to be a better victim. That's the language I would use. I would say if it's pacification, it's not improvement. If it's emotion regulation is a term that we use a lot in the therapeutic profession, but it's basically a band-aid, right? So if you have severe trauma, you have to learn how to function in the world. And sometimes that involves breathing exercises that help you come out of a flashback or something that is making you feel like you're derealizing, right? Having a derealization episode. Now, getting out of that is kind of an emotion regulation thing. Now, hitting the root cause so you don't have the flashbacks anymore, that's real self-improvement and mental health. But a lot of the stuff out there now is, as we could describe it, this sort of temporary band-aid fix that gets packaged as more than it's worth, right? Like if you just think you're great, you'll be great. It's like, well, it takes a little more work than that. That's not really self-improvement. That's just some kind of cognitive sleight of hand that works for maybe 5 minutes. I mean, I think people have to learn because what the worst of what happens is people who are very high in conscientiousness and high in neuroticism will think that they're doing something wrong. And it's almost like the prosperity gospel where people think they didn't believe hard enough, so their cancer came back, right? It's like, well, I didn't think positively enough, so I'm not feeling better, so it's my fault. It's like, no, sometimes you have to do a little more than what an Instagram model tells you to do to have a perfect life.
Well, I'd say that that's largely down to contemporary relationship with suffering and pain.
Say more about that.
Well, the problem there is that I think a lot of people, especially in the West, see pain and suffering and death ultimately all as bugs, not features. So when pain and suffering comes along, it's not something you learn from. You immediately, you're coping with it, or you're like repressing it, or you're pushing it away. And right. if you're suffering, even you know, emotional suffering as well as physical, like, you know, cutting off your finger or something, mm-hmm. it's something that's absolutely abhorrent to the Western notion of sort of normality, because it just shouldn't be. When, you know, as Junger says, tell me your relationship to pain and I'll tell you who you are. So I think that's the thing we need to learn again.
Yes.
One of the big things as well is the person I previously mentioned, Gurdjieff. It would be outstandingly controversial today to become like a public point of view, I think, but I adore it. And he states that actually one of the things that he had his students sort of do before they, he could sort of say that they were making progress in his system, the fourth way, was to say that they've given up their sort of their vices. Now, a lot of people in the West think this is easy because they can outline material vices like, oh, I've given up my flashy car, I've given up my house, I'm living in a smaller house, or maybe,
right.
you know, they're all sharing in a thing, or maybe I've given up eating like super, you know, takeout, blah, blah, blah. But actually Gurdjieff says, yeah, sure, they're vices. But actually your biggest vices, the ones that are toughest to see, are the ones that you wallow in all the time, which is self-pity, despair, depression, anxiety. And he says that these are your true vices because you utilize them and use them all the time to sort of forgive yourself for mistakes which you could consciously avoid and wallow in them all the time. So these are truly your vices. So I think that needs to come back in, that discussion of saying, well, hang on, not man up, because I think, but a more abstract form of man up, as in, don't expect to just go to the doctors and get a pill and all of a sudden your depression goes away. I mean, I'm a big fan of the R.D. Lang's short story he gives, where the person with depression is sat in the dungeon but the door's unlocked, right? And he says, you can walk out anytime. You just got to make the choice. You just got to say, I don't want to be in here anymore. But he says, well, no, you know, I've got to find out why I got in here. He says, you don't have to find out how you got in here. Just leave. And I'm a big fan of that. And I think that's Gurdjieff's point as well, is people get very comfortable in those dungeons. They just sort of wallow in them. And it excuses them of a lot of responsibility.
Well, we're going really deep here, and I love this because this is about to go into R.D. Lang. I learned about him very briefly in grad school. He was like a footnote or a little less than a paragraph, I think, in a chapter in a family.
Yeah, of course.
And so then
they're the best ones. When they don't really want to put them in, they're the ones you should follow up.
Oh, yeah. So his anti-psychiatry movement. I mean, the man was highly educated. He was a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. He wasn't someone who decided one day he was going to be a teacher. He really went through the paces of the Western machine, saw what he didn't like, and started his own thing.
It was a massive failure.
Yeah.
I think it was a failure on a practical level.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the time that things were getting into the managed care system, I think, and where you couldn't do that kind of stuff. I mean, even in the mid-20th century, that was becoming, I think, the way of the commune, doing things of that nature was a little bit rough. So, mm-hmm. But there's kind of a spiritual success of a very, very loose connection here would be solution-focused therapy, where you instead of doing problem talk, you do solution talk, which that sounds kind of like trite. But the point is, one of the things therapists will say is the solution isn't always related to the problem. So that idea of, I don't have to know how I got here. Let's talk about how I can get out. That is the kind of brainchild of people who moved away from that psychoanalytic view. The psychoanalytic view is, I need to know why I'm in here. And not only that, but I need to know how the dungeon was built. I need to know what it's built of. I need to know at what age I even, like, how old.
The problem with that is, to spout something relatively controversial, is that I think it's been found that a lot of people are more than happy in those circumstances just to have a figure of authority spout whatever at them, and they'll go, that must be it, right? I think there's a lot to be said for the psychological sunk cost of paying someone week in, week out, a lot of money, for them to construct this big sort of potentially a fantasy, which you then go, it's this. Oh, why did I do that? You know, why did I do that silly thing last week? Oh, it was because of something to do with, you know, my relationship with my father or whatever. And I think that's all can be very interesting. As for the evidence or proof of that, mm-hmm. I think people, that's just another comfort blanket. This is the whole point of Anti-Oedipus, I think, is behind a lot of what Deleuze and Guattari are writing. If you were to sort of explain it in a very short sentence, would be, but what if psychoanalysis is a load of bull?
Right, yes.
Not just psychoanalysis, but Oedipal structures, of which psychoanalysis is one. What if, you know, that's post-structuralism?
Yeah. No, I think very well said. And I think one of the big issues there is the medical establishment and the therapeutic establishment, people being tired of that. There are people who would rather go to a really good life coach who is really just someone who's a framework for accountability, right? So that accountability to change and do something different rather than get an easy answer. Some people really want that. And I think one of the big things is you should get your pride as a therapist or healer.
I think the problem is as well is that life coaches, therapists, there's easy answers. They almost give you a get out of jail free card for when you do make mistakes. It's like, oh, it's fine, I'm doing this and this and this. And I think really you can't just keep, I think there's it should be like 95% yourself. I'm completely on board with, I know this is your career, so I sort of, there'll always be people to talk, chat to and therapists, but I really am on board with, you know, you can drag a horse to water, but you can't make a drink. All the times in my life when people just need help, but don't, if they don't do it, they just don't do it. And
that's true.
Sort of a genetic people hate to talk about genetics and sort of, because there's something very fatalist about genetics. You know, no one wants to say, oh, we can't help that person. But I lean far, far further to that side of things of, unfortunately, the universe isn't fair. And some people will be born in the same way someone might be born very, very short. Someone might be born with, you know, a predisposition for eating sugary things and getting, you know, fat. However, someone might also be born with a predisposition that they just aren't going to amount to that much in the confines of the civilizations that we've built and in the contexts that we live within. And from there, I think it's better to accept that and then go from there. You know, I guess then that's what, in a certain sense, Foucault et al. Who are addressing is, well, if you have these people, who are we to force this normativity onto them and say that you have to be X or Y? That seems to be a more productive way to go about it, rather than sculpting and then saying you're a failure. It's saying, well, no, this is a, you know, it's the positivity thing again. It's a problem of dialectics in a way, is that if you have that negation, then you're stating that there is a positive normal which everyone has to go towards and that anything else is negative. Well, yes. How about that if someone doesn't fit into the societal context that we've given, that they are a positive, but they just need their own context, whether or not you want to, you know, there's certain contexts I certainly don't want to live within. I don't want to live in a communist context, for instance, but there's plenty of people who positively can go try that if they like, away from me.
Well, I mean, I am someone who really stays away from controversy. I'll just say that right now. I think any of my listeners and anyone who follows me on social media will know I don't regularly do shit posting or stir up trouble. So when I say I don't think it's that controversial, I mean, it means something. I don't think it's controversial to say people have different thresholds for emotional regulation, for attention, right? People may have to struggle more with ADHD, but be more creative. And their cross to bear is that they...
Does ADHD exist though?
That's a great question.
I mean, you put an 8-year-old boy or girl who's got bundles of energy in a confined classroom and say you have to listen to this boring teacher for 8 hours a day under fluorescent lights and you're not allowed to move. When you're young and you want to go out and, you know, it seems that most kids want to be kinesthetic learners.
Oh, yeah.
In that context, then to say that when you begin to look at it like that, and some kid who's fidgeting or something, who wants to shout out, when you put it in that context, which Foucault, I guess, would in a certain sense, and Ivan Illich would, and John Taylor Gatto would, you can then just, it's very easy to say anyone who's fidgeting in the context that we've created, the productive societal context we've created, they've got this thing. Right, but that's just complete rubbish. It's just something you disagree with in the context that you agree, you know, something you found a fault in the context that you've created. Well, that's fine, but you created the context. So don't then, and I think that's the horrible thing is then these kids, I think it then spirals for these kids that they feel like they're failures. But they're only failures, deemed failures, signified as failures in the context they've been given. Elsewhere, they'll probably be fine. Right.
No, absolutely. Well, so I'll jump in here.
So I think that maybe the best thing to do with kids with ADHD is just say, okay, it's fair enough. You can't sit in a fluorescently lit classroom all day. How about we go learn to, I don't know, build a house?
So you may be surprised. I'm actually pretty vocal on, like, I don't believe in over-medication. I don't believe that someone should be trained to adapt to a situation that maybe is not optimal for them. So as far as ADHD stuff goes, that may not be the best example. I actually was homeschooled for a majority, for quite a few years. And I had private classes I went to with some other kids, and parents would just pay a teacher or a professor to teach. So there was still an element of sitting down, but there was less of that. And it was less sitting for its own sake. And it was sitting for classes. Like, I didn't really have a homeroom. There was study hall stuff, but it was like, not everything was like there was a purpose for it. So I totally get your, let's say, issues with the context of learning an 8-year-old child having to sit and maybe being more kinesthetic learner. I think we've really got to do a lot of work on that. So I'll use the example of people have a lower or higher threshold for dealing with anxiety, right? So that is something that biologically we've seen a lot of evidence for. We've seen, meaning that some people are going to have to do more self-talk and deep breathing, things like that, to handle stressors. That happens. That is more what we can go on to your point of it's not fair that people are born different. So some people need more tools for dealing with stuff than others. Again, I'm going back to dialectical behavior therapy, a very accepted, very appropriate, non-contested therapy. So I think we have to be realistic with people. And what happens is when you get a therapist's desire to be liked, and to continue getting money from a client, I can say it, I'm in the field. I don't think all therapists are bad. I do think if you have an unconscious need to be liked that you haven't explored, the worst ethics would be someone actually consciously trying to keep clients dependent, right? When we have stuff in the code of conduct, but I mean, people break codes of conduct all the time, sadly. So keeping people dependent on you, it's a big no-no. Get referrals, get new clients. You should have time-limited work with clients. That way you have a goal and an urgency to do it. And that solution-focused therapy actually tries to keep stuff brief so that you're telling the client, look, you have me for this limited time. It introduces urgency, right? So there needs to be some urgency and time limitation, and there needs to be therapists who aren't afraid to say things that could actually even offend, not because there are offenses.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is I think if a lot of therapists are probably, the skin in the game is so deep that they can't upset, right? It's sort of the deconstructionist and post-structuralist problem once again. It's sure, they deconstruct, you know, all these overarching ideas and ideals that we've had, but they never deconstruct the platform that they've been given, right? They never deconstruct the academy. And therapists are never going to critique their own system because everyone wants a paycheck. So, you know, there's a point where potentially what would help the client is sort of deconstructing all the context of modernity that they've built up in their head. But by doing that, they're going to begin to understand that the therapist is in, within those contexts. So there's a fine line where if you say certain things and they begin to understand certain things about themselves, they're no longer going to believe they need a therapist.
Good. I mean, for me, I think, but again, right? Like, I'm not speaking for every therapist and I'm not saying I'm the best therapist out there, but I think, in fact, I think the good news, I mean, I haven't even been doing it a decade yet. I've been in the field for over 6 years. And I think anyone that has some degree of insight about themselves needs to realize there are going to be times where you have to say, look, I think we're circling here. What can we do different? This is a tangential thing here that's relevant. People don't really learn that you can be assertive without being rude. I think there are a lot of therapists who are afraid to say, hey, we've talked about this a bunch and I've suggested stuff and it's not working. Have you tried it? Is this not something that you think is going to work for you? What's going on here? I mean, something like that. You can say, I don't think we're making progress. Do you need a referral? How are you feeling about our work? Tell me what you're, and you can politely push things in a way where, but again, are you inclined to do that? Or is it easier to chat through an hour and get paid? So clients don't know what they don't know. If your bone is broken, you know what the problem is and you know what the solution is. If you've got anxiety or depression, you may not know what the solution is, or even for a while that's a problem. And so the more abstract something is, the more an expert can come in and essentially dominate your discourse of thought or introduce something that you don't know is unfalsifiable or unhelpful.
You know, I don't know maybe I need to look into the statistics, but the increase, what I mean to say is the increased prevalency of depression and anxiety in recent years, you know, the last 20, 40 years. Mm-hmm. Historically, has it ever been this high? Or is it just not? What, you know, there's either two options there. It wasn't there because we lived a different lifestyle, which was more contemptible and fulfilling for us. Mm-hmm. Or it was there, but we never considered it a thing. We considered it as a matter of fact part of life. And as soon as you introduce the idea that something is very wrong with feeling a certain way, you introduce that the idea that people need to all sort something out, as opposed to perhaps it's a bit healthier to understand that life isn't all. As soon as you introduce the idea of depression, you sort of introduce the counter idea that if that isn't normal, then the complete opposite is normal, which is like, you know, well, it must be happiness. Yeah. What about that huge middle ground? And also, who said that being somewhat miserable, as long as it's not on the side of suicidal? I mean, historically, there's lots of people who are miserable but are productive and led fulfilling lives. Schopenhauer, who's the most miserable man who ever existed. Diogenes, to a certain extent. I think the way it's framed is done so by Western society that believes we all need to be these sort of happy, productive members. You know, you need to be productive and you need to be happy about it. Mm. You know, it's sort of this idea that retail staff should have to be, you know, be polite, but why do you have to have a smile and be joyous? Like, is it as if maybe you're frowning, is something actually wrong with you? Well, maybe you just aren't a happy person. That doesn't mean that you find life intolerable.
Right. Well, what a good question, man. The way I would address that is a bit of a cop-out and say, I think it's both. I think that our culture now has hurtled inexorably, exponentially toward isolation, and that if you look at the fragmentation of the idea of tribe, like people used to be embedded within tribes where everyone had a sort of contribution, at least in some way, right? Like, I think the apprenticeship model is really good for professional life. I think when you have a boss who's invested in you, not as an employee, but as kind of an entire unit, that's more beneficial. I think we look at the people living alone, kind of in an apartment. There's a lot of isolation now. I'm not going to get too much on that tangent. And I think when someone identifies with their disorder, it makes it worse, and then they identify more with it, and it makes it worse, and they identify more with it, and it becomes like living as a label. And so if you think, I am an anxious person, again, like this stuff that we're saying that can sound kind of controversial, there's actually a big movement that's apolitical to tell people, like, say that you have anxiety versus, or that anxiety is interfering versus I'm an anxious person. Like when you start to identify and imbibe, like in your book, you talk about language invading. And so your trip begins when language begins invading your understanding of things. If anxiety becomes your framework and you are anxiety, you're going to have more of it. So I think you nailed, I think it's isolation and it's living by this label and saying, well, I have anxiety, so this explains everything. If that's your explanatory framework, you're not going to be able to escape it. You can say, mm-hmm. I suffer anxiety and it comes up but I'm switching it. I'm choosing to do something different and to turn that channel off mentally. You're not gonna be able to do that if you think you can't.
Well, yeah, it's turning that channel off. It's turning the channel off, but it's also saying, actually, does this channel exist? Does it exist in the way that I think it does? Who created this channel? Why do I think about this channel the way I do? You know, who's taught me that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's very important. I mean, I've seen posts and I've seen things on Tumblr, which I think part of this, by the way, is people self-diagnosing. So I've seen things about like people having anxiety at giving group presentations and saying, well, I need a teacher's note. I need to get out of this. So I did public speaking in high school. I did debate with a bunch of other kids. And there were times, like the first time I did it, there was some anxiety there. And then even the
there's a big problem with that. I think I've heard from some of the teachers I know that,
sure. Right.
You know, you hear on the radio about kids saying about anxiety about exams as if anxiety about exams is a thing. No. You get anxious in big moments in your life that are of sort of almost existential importance.
Yes.
To sort of frame that out of its context and then begin to think that you're an anxious person is just, that's just dangerous. And you end up on a medication, which you really shouldn't be on.
Well, and it does someone a disservice to be told that they can't overcome this and that they have to. I mean, look, there's severe test anxiety, and I believe that's a thing. I think there's a difference between pervasive anxiety. Well, and you might say, is there, right? That might be the thing. Like, does this channel exist? I get what you're asking. From my perspective, I think people will live to what labels we give them. People, there's an aphorism that people will live
down. I wasn't going to say, you know, what is that? I was going to say that anxiety is born from a context which those people who want people to pass exams don't want to admit to. So the reason they are anxious about these exams is because they believe in the whole context and structure of modernity. And the people who have sort of love modernity and want all these jobs and, you know, you're born, you have your education, you get your job, you retire and you die. The people who want this don't want you to feel anxious about it. They want you to just sort of flow into it. And it's anxious. I think you're anxious really because the any meaning in your life is resting on this free floating thing. And I think probably if you looked at it, the people who aren't less anxious about exams are those who, you know, obviously have other meaning in their lives other than the job they get or the people they're probably people who don't want to actually, they don't care about pleasing other people.
I definitely think that people have to, like, there's different levels of ability to memorize and spit out facts for an exam.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean you're
different. Well, there's a difference between knowledge and understanding, and schools have no understanding. They don't teach understanding.
And that's from your book too. I remember that quote. And it has to do with like pragmatism and knowledge versus wisdom, in my opinion. But that's a whole different, thing.
Like, yeah. It's like, no.
You just learn this because you do, right? That's just what you do. You need to know this. Well, why? Because that's part of the curriculum. Why is it part of the curriculum? Well, because we determine that this is what.
That's not learning though. That's data entry. That's memorization.
Bingo. But that's why it's considered a lot of learning, I think.
Well, yeah, but it's not actually by definition learning. I think learning, you know, it's just not. I could go memorize a medical textbook. At least. Let's say, just devil's advocate, I could.
Yeah, of course.
Then let's say, you know, small or short one. And then let's say that someone, and I'd pretend to be a doctor, someone comes in with something that I haven't memorized.
Yeah.
Learn, someone who's actually learned from experience, those who have experience and learn from lecturers and learn from, well, like I said, those who have experience would probably be able to apply the knowledge and work out what this other problem is. Whereas I think if you're just memorizing, I just don't think that's there. Same. No. It's like a good teacher, I think, will mention things outside of the curriculum which are relevant. Yeah.
That's so let me ask you some questions, if you don't mind, from people who I asked if anybody had any questions for you. And I wanted to ask from Joel Jensen Heath, could you ask James about Nick's interest around the lemurs?
Well, the Lemurian thing, it's in the CCRU writings. It's the whole basis of the Nemogram. There's a text. If you type in Lemurian Time War, it will actually come up on Google. That's the main text there. So it runs pretty deep. I mean, I don't want to spoil your journey, but the lemurs are still here now, as I understand it. So yeah, that's all I'd say. I'd just say read CCRU writings, and you'll find much more about the lemurs.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with the Lemurian Time War. I actually printed out a PDF about that, and I remember reading it. So, but I just wanted to ask the question one. Okay, another one is from Hal Conti. Can you ask about what Sadie Plant is up to these days and the influence of the Situationists on the CCRU / Nick Land in the 1990s?
I haven't read any Situationists, so I couldn't tell you about the influence. As for what Sadie Plant is up to, I've heard she sort of exited the Academy before anyone in that group, I believe. And yeah. I think she still doesn't really want anything to do with this kind of stuff from what I've heard. Could be complete nonsense.
Sure. So what about Land's relation to more recent transhumanist or accelerationist projects such as xenofeminism and beyond? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know if he does. I haven't seen a direct relation between. There's definitely a relation between Land and xenofeminism to be found, for sure. Okay. Especially in Zero. Zero is everywhere. You probably want to look to Amy Ireland for that, though. She did a great interview on the meaning of the word cunt. Am I allowed to say that on your show? Yeah. And xenofeminism, which is a great read. It's in the context. I'm not using it crassly. As for the transhumanism, it's tough to answer because there's post-humanism, transhumanism.
Right.
I would argue, which does come feature in the book a bit, that as soon as that word humanism is there, I wonder whether or not Land is actually on board. Simply because that's sort of undefinable in Landian philosophy and what it's going towards and the outside, which it's interacting with at all times, is the thing that potentially may eventually allow us to define what humanism actually is. So yeah, I'd be skeptical of transhumanist ideas, except as a cyberpunk aesthetic.
Right. Transhumanism, humanism, all these terms have been bandied about so much.
There's a good book by David Roden called Posthuman Life, where he sort of defines these things.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Well, we'll see if your blog predictions come true. I think that you throw out that's very likely. I've thought about this too, is that people continue to engage in certain distancing behaviors and wearing masks and just thinking this is how you conduct yourself, even when the vaccine is readily available and there's kind of the mitigating things that render that unnecessary. People will continue doing it. That's how habit works. So I think you're on some good footing there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like an abuse of habit though, right? The government introduced all these measures. They're in for long enough that we get used to them and you no longer think about putting on a mask or washing your hands. And then eventually they don't explicitly say they're removing them. They've ever removed the measures and let's say they never do. They just never announce it. People would just keep going on. People would just keep wearing them, I think. And that is sort of a very boring form of fascism. You know, it's almost like a gaslighting form of fascism. I mean, the worry there on a biological level is that you know, you wrap people in cotton wool. If we wore masks all the time and weren't ingesting germs and bugs like we should do all the time, we wouldn't even be able to like eventually deal with a common cold. And we'd be reliant then on antibiotics more and more, and the antibiotic crisis would just accelerate. So I, you know, if it was me, strip the masks off and accept the deaths. People die. It happens. Some, you know, bugs like these are going to come along. And I think it's almost wrong for the human race to assume that, you know, we're absolutely superior to all animals, except, you know, a microbe. Things like this will happen. And they have happened. And they do happen.
Kind of an accelerationist view.
No, not at all. I'm not saying like accelerate the I'm not saying accelerate corona. I'm saying the attitude towards death, I think, is quite unhealthy. But that's just me. And I have lost one person within the corona epidemic. So this is not like it hasn't affected me, and I'm saying this. So there you go.
I'm sorry for that. That sucks.
Oh, no, it's fine.
Jeez. I noticed that the book was published in Columbia, South Carolina, which is so fascinating because I actually am from South Carolina.
Oh, no. It's just published by, it's printed by Amazon, probably in their most local printers.
Oh, that's what that is. Okay, never mind.
Well, yeah, mine was like printed in, my proofs were printed in Poland, which is apparently the closest one to the UK, which is weird.
Wow, yeah, that's
so, yeah, sorry to bust it. Bye-bye.
I don't care. It says it on there, so I thought it was cool. I do like the healthy reference list here of the abbreviations, because I've read some stuff and they don't really give it. And it's like, well, that's fine. All right, I'll Google it. So do you have a favorite work from Land? A favorite of any kind? I know that's
if I had to go and read up a whole Land text again, if it was a full text.
Yeah.
It would be the Thirst for Annihilation, 100%. I think that's just an outstanding piece of philosophy. If it was one essay, if I said essay, then it would be After the Law, which is found in Fangling Manor. And then if it was one online piece, it's Hellbaked, 100%. It's Hellbaked on Xenophystems. But I do believe Cryptocurrent will be his magnum opus in terms of philosophy. And I heard just the other day that as soon as that came out, crypto people were just like, weren't speaking about anything else for weeks when after that came out. So it's news to me.
So what does Land think of your book? Have you guys spoken?
I emailed him to ask for a couple of lines, which I think he's gonna do, but he hasn't said anything yet. I'll see either way. I don't mind.
I don't know. That's cool. I mean, that's because you've interviewed how many times? Just the once or more than that on your show, Hermetics
podcast? I've only interviewed him once. We tried to do a second one, but it didn't work.
Okay. Yeah. I was that you interviewed Greer a few times.
Oh, yeah. Like I think we're on 7. And now Greer emailed me the other day to say we're just going to start sending you all my new releases and we'll just do an interview every single time.
Nice. a book,
which is like 3 times a year.
It's very prolific. I'll definitely.
He's insane. No. It's mad. Yeah. I'm a big fan, and I can't keep up.
I had to actually look up some of the stuff in the book about magic because I am not an initiate.
Oh, in my book?
Yes, in Goetic Magic. In
So some of that is dramatized and we say diverted from the fact of what people could do if they looked hard enough.
Right.
Simply because you don't reveal everything you found out. So there's stuff put in there to sort of spice it up and make it sound, you know, like the Abra Malin operation comes in, which isn't really too relevant to the reality.
Okay.
But it was a way to move the narrative along.
No, it was, but I also, I mean, so for anyone who's listening to this as they should be, as a part two, I will say in our part one, you discussed your initiation and involvement in some magical practices and then noting that like you'd throw screws into a bucket and they'd be standing up straight, things like that, coincidental things. And I was like, oh, well, this was really part of some, I mean, the fiction, I will say, it's written very well because this overlaps and it's par for the course in a book like this about Nick Land. Like the fiction and the reality for anyone that knows you at all, even after talking to you for an hour like I had, I think they kind of will wonder, how real is there any truth to this? So
yeah, they can keep wondering.
Exactly. That's fine. But it's funny because usually I would assume that something magic related is completely fiction. But after having interviewed you and talked about Greer and all of your interviews with magical characters.
Whenever anyone says that, I would say, even though I don't promote magic now, but if they're truly a skeptic and they're getting a bit annoying about, oh, it's not real, I would say, go put all your will into casting a sigil and see what happens. And if it doesn't do anything, it doesn't do anything. If it does.
Yeah.
Like, what's going to hurt? What's it going to hurt? That's what I always say. And then, you know, I'll be there when things go, you know, you get scared because it worked. And I'll say, it's fine.
No, I don't doubt that. I mean, it's interesting because I think you and I are both, you're Christian, right?
No. Yeah. Since all that moved back fairly hastily.
Yeah, I'm a Christian as well. So my skepticism for magic is not even like the idea that it can't exist, but that a lot of it is such sleight of hand or life coach stuff where like psychics taking people's money and stuff. It's like, how much of that does exist? The same thing you could say with a lot of prosperity gospel stuff too. That cuts anyway that supernatural is involved. So anyway, I really want to hand it over to you. And I know we've been chatting a while here. So what I want to do is leave you full space, free reign, whatever, to say anything you wish I'd asked about the book or anything you want to say about the book or your work in general, man. Totally your game.
There's not much I want to say about the book. I mean, I'm not...
Go buy it.
No. Yeah. I mean, that's nice. It's nice if people buy it. But actually, I'm more happy that it's just out there. And I'd much prefer 100 people who genuinely really are interested in the work of Nick Land and they're going to enjoy it than, you know, 1,000 people who bought it because they sort of memed into it or whatever. So, you know, I don't know, that's a pretentious thing to say, like, oh, I don't care about the money. Like, yeah, sure, it'd be nice if you bought it because I do get a bit of money. It allows me to do more things and produce more books or whatever. But, you know, if it's something you're interested in, then go buy it. So it's going to be there. People who've read it so far have all enjoyed it. And it's probably not what you expect it's going to be, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and that I appreciate that's really a circumspect, mature view of it. I mean, and then people could be like, ooh, what is this? He's not really asking us to buy it. Now I'm going to go buy it.
No, it's not reverse psychology.
I know, I know. I'm totally joking around.
No, that's okay. No, just if it isn't your kind of thing, no doubt. But yeah, go buy it. There you go. It's on Amazon.
I love the cover. Who did that? What is that?
It's just it's a meme. It's a Wojak. It's a screaming meme. I thought less people would know what it is, but actually a lot of people. But I think in 5 years, people might not. But
I know Wojak. I've watched.
Yeah, it's like the melting face one.
It's a what?
It's like the melting face Wojak. Got it. But yeah, so there's that. Just me and I worked on it with a friend of mine. It's just me and a friend worked on that cover, and there will be hardbacks actually next Monday. So in 3 days' time, I'm going to the printers to sort out whether or not they can do a hardback, which to the standard that I want, which is sort of will be a cloth bound, you know, it'll look aesthetically sort of like a very dark occult book.
Yeah, I think that's very fitting. That is pretty cool. How long have you been going by James Ellis now, fully out?
Since I was born.
Yeah.
Right. No. Ever since I did the season, April.
Nice. Yeah, boy, that's been a while. God, I can't believe it.
Yeah, it just didn't matter to me. And I don't think I've dampened my views at all. Yeah.
God, I mean, again, like this year has been very fascinating, to say the least. I think it's somewhere between what people say on like, well, if you haven't done something amazing in 2020, you haven't tried hard enough. There's those people and there's the ones who are like, well, don't try anything. It's like, kind of got to do
I just sort of finish by saying that anyone who says to me, don't try anything, I would just cut them out of my life.
Yeah, even if it's...
What's the point in having people like that around?
The worst...
Yeah, it'd be horrible.
...patronizing way to do that and be like, well, you don't have to challenge yourself. It's like, well, that... You have to a bit, right? That's being human. So...
Yeah.
Wild stuff. All right, anything else you want to add while we're recording?
No, man.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book, and... I'm going to tell people I really enjoyed the second half, which is the half where we don't want to spoil the journey. So, but if you really want to know, I think this is really useful to people as a sort of secondary source on Nick Land. And I mean, I took notes on your different ways of describing the concept of zero. That was very helpful for me. It's like an infection that once you hear it, once you learn of it, you're never the same. It's like, that's a very fascinating concept. So, of course, it pervades his work, but it's the way you explain, I think, may be helpful for people who are brand new. So, I'm gonna learn about Nick Land. There you go. All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you.